Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear a lot about rural areas that don't have access to high-speed internet. Our guest says it's a big problem in urban America for some surprising reasons. First, presidential candidates are spending a lot of time campaigning in Iowa ahead of the state's caucus in February. That kicks off a primary season where the rules can feel a little bit random. Some states have caucuses, others have primary elections, and those can be open to anyone, restricted to party members, or kind of somewhere in between. So how did we end up with this mix-and-match fractured primary system, and how does it impact who ultimately gets nominated? Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow in governance studies and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. She's the author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, primary season hasn't always been the way it is now. When did kind of our modern system, still a patchwork, come into being?
The modern nomination system came into being in 1972. It was the direct result of reforms that the Democratic Party started in 1968 after their very raucous convention and a lot of disruption within the party. And from 1972 on, the Democratic system changed pretty dramatically, and the Republican system changed as well. So it's really 1972 on that we consider the modern nominating system.
And that's an important point. I think a lot of us think elections, that's something run by the government. But in these primaries, in determining who's running on each ticket for president, the parties have a lot to say about it.
Well, yes. Basically, the nomination of somebody to be the standard bearer of a party is the business of the party. It's not a wide publicized business. In most of the democracies of the world, a very much smaller group of people who are party officials control the nomination process. They determine who gets to run as their standard bearer. What we did that, by the way, prior to 1972. What happened with the reforms that started to take place in 72 is that we moved as a nation from having party officials determine the nominee of their party to having voters in primaries determine the nominee of the party. And that was a pretty dramatic change, even in the American context, but definitely in the context of democracies around the world.
Did that change the role of the party then? Because once upon a time, I think it would have been unimaginable to have someone on the Republican ticket or Democratic ticket who wasn't a longtime party member. Now we have Donald Trump, who wasn't really a Republican, and then second place to Bernie Sanders, who wasn't really a Democrat. That's kind of a new innovation, right?
Right. That's very new. In the pre-1972 system, you would not have had Trump or Sanders winning or even coming close to winning the nomination of the party, because one of the things that was valued was service to and loyalty to the party. So the party – that didn't mean that the parties didn't have, by the way, their internal ideological fights. They certainly did. But they were fought out amongst people like in 1964, Barry Goldwater, who was a very, very conservative Republican, kind of a harbinger of the conservative Republican Party we see today, and more moderate Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller. But both of them were people with substantial public sector experience and a long history with the Republican Party.
Let's now look at the system we have in place. Here in Wisconsin, we have a primary. It's an open primary. You can go in and vote. You have to stick with just one party in that particular election, but you don't have to register as a member. Our neighbors, some of whom are listening in Iowa, they have caucuses. It seems like they're in caucuses all the time. What's the deal with caucuses for those of us not in a caucus state? How do they work?
Well, the big difference between a caucus and a primary is that in a caucus, the voter has to actually attend a meeting and participate in a meeting. So, you know, in a primary, you can go vote after you drop off the kids for school or before you go to work or after work or any time you want to during the day. In a caucus, it takes place at a certain time, usually from like 7 p.m. till 10 p.m., and you go and you vote as you go in, but then if your candidate doesn't reach the 15% threshold, you get to vote again for a candidate who is more popular. So, and there's usually other business conducted at that caucus as well, the platform resolutions, et cetera. So it's a more intensive form of participation, but it also involves less people because not everybody can take the kind of time you need to go to a caucus.
Do caucuses generally have a different kind of outcome? Do they favor one type of candidate over another?
Well, in both parties, caucuses have tended to favor candidates who have intense followings, sometimes ideological, sometimes not. So, for instance, in the 2008 race between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama did much better in caucuses than Hillary did. In fact, as my book shows, most of his delegate advantage against versus Hillary in 2008 came from his big wins in caucus states. So Hillary had sort of widespread support, but not very deep. And Obama had also widespread support, but a lot of it was very intense. So it's a kind of measure. Sometimes it's an ideological intensity. Sometimes it's just simply a depth of feeling for your candidate because the caucus requires a lot more time than the primary does.
Talking to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution, author of the book Primary Politics. We're talking about how we nominate presidents for the major party tickets in this country. You can join in if you have thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Elaine, I've been reading we now have fewer caucus states this time around. It seems like the trend is away from caucusing. Is that right?
Yeah, we are down to about six caucus states, not counting the sort of territories and you know, places that aren't states. We're down to six. And this is a result of two things. First of all, there was a commission after the 2016 campaign that looked at these and recommended that states that had primaries on the law, on statute, should really start using their primaries because simply a lot more people can participate in primaries. Because of the nature of a caucus, if you're disabled, if you're elderly, if you've got a new baby at home, if you're deployed in the military, you really can't participate easily in a caucus. The second reason that the caucuses are kind of disappearing is that we are in a day and age of intense polarization, but that also means intense interest and turnout. And frankly, some of these big states, the number of people participating in caucuses is huge. And while on the one hand, that was very good because obviously, we want a lot of people to be interested in and participate in politics. On the other hand, it creates a burden for that system that states just had trouble managing. And a lot of us on the Rules Committee in the Democratic Party, and I think I can speak for my fellow rules junkies in the Republican Party, were afraid that these caucuses were simply too big to manage effectively anymore.
Then there's the question of the order in which we do these things. Iowa goes first. New Hampshire does it second. I think South Carolina is third. I assume somewhere there's a stone tablet where that order is carved and never shall it be violated, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, this has been the order, the sequence, who goes first, is something that emerged after the Democratic reforms and in the new primary system. New Hampshire was always first. New Hampshire has been first since the turn of the century, since about 1921 or something. Okay, it's always been the first primary. What made it more important is that when we went to a system of all primaries, something called momentum developed. And what momentum really means is that the decision of voters in one contest has an impact on the decision of voters in the next contest and on and on throughout the 4 or 5 months of the nomination season. So New Hampshire got to be very important. And before it, Iowa got to be very important. Iowa becomes important in 1976 when Jimmy Carter, a total unknown, emerges really out of nowhere and wins the Iowa caucus and then goes on to win the nomination and the presidency. So these two states particularly have held on to their first place for quite some time. We went through a couple years where everybody was complaining about this, and one of the sources of complaints was that those are both states that are majority white with very few minorities. So the Democrats in the 2000s added South Carolina, which has a very large African-American population, and Nevada, which has a very large Latino population. And then in a surprising bit of bipartisan cooperation, the two political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, agreed to hold the same sequence of primaries. So for the last few races, last few times nomination contests have been held, both the Republican parties and the Democratic parties begin their nomination system in those four states. And that has lessened the confusion and also stopped, at least temporarily, other states from trying to jump the queue and causing chaos in the system.
We're talking to Elaine K. Marx, senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She's the author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. We are talking about the patchwork system we have for presidential primaries, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that baffles you about our nomination system? I promise you're not alone. Do you think it should be more uniform? What type of election would you like to see be the standard? Is there something in either party system or both party system that you think needs to change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Elaine K. Marx from the Brookings Institution, author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. And you can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how the nomination system works, the primaries, the caucuses, and so forth? Would you like to see one model for how we do it that works in every state? Should the order change? What do you want to see change, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elaine, I've seen an argument that kind of decreasing the power of the party to control who gets nominated might be a mixed blessing. I mean, some people didn't like the smoke-filled rooms necessarily where the party faithful decided who it was going to be. But some people have also said, hey, wait a minute, you're basically just saying that it's so important who the president is, the personality, it makes this one power block for the personality of the president. Where do you fall on that back and forth?
Well, I do think it's a mixed bag. I mean, there were lots of problems with the smoke-filled rooms. On the other hand, they did nominate Dwight D. Eisenhower, Franklin Roosevelt, and a bunch of other presidents that we think are pretty good. In the old-fashioned system, it was a system where basically elected officials of that party and party leaders of that party had the final say over who became their nominee. The advantage of the old system was that they actually, unlike the voters today, these people actually knew the potential presidents, and they could make judgments about that person's temperament, about their ability to work across the aisle, ability to work with the legislature, ability to understand complex public policy issues, and whether or not the person could get elected. There was something in that we call peer review. Now, think about this. If you are going to have brain surgery, you want somebody who has been peer reviewed as a doctor who is competent at cutting open your brain. And ditto for many other things, even manicurists, right? We have our manicurists get licensed because we want to make sure that they know what their job is. The Office of President of the United States is one of the few important jobs in the country where we have no peer review anymore. And that means that celebrity makes a big difference. And so celebrity can get you onto a debate stage. Celebrity can get you people calling you a potential president of the United States. So in the last couple of years, we've had spiritual gurus, we've had pizza entrepreneurs, we've had all sorts of people running for president who, frankly, in the old system, and not to mention reality television stars, running for president who in the old system would have never been considered seriously for president. My sense here is that we need to have elements of both in a nomination system and that we've gone too far in the other direction, and it's potentially very dangerous.
Let's bring on our callers now. Joe is with us in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Joe?
I was wondering if there has been any push towards a national primary wherein all states would primary on the same day to possibly remove some of that momentum that was spoken about before. Seems to me that momentum is a sort of a way of kind of negating the whole idea of like a secret ballot. If you see that 49 states have already voted towards a particular candidate, you'd be less likely to vote against that.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Elaine, this would be a big change. Have people made the case for that in the past?
Yeah, Joe brings up a really good point. There have been lots of calls for a national primary. It would have to be done through Congress, right? And Congress has been very loath to get involved in the business of nomination because, as I said at the outset, this is basically a party decision, not a public decision. And the two political parties have never been very interested in a national primary. So you would need an act of Congress. There have been over 100 bills introduced over the years to establish a national primary. None of them have gotten out of committee. None of them have even gone to a vote. And even if one did to a vote and pass, there is a constitutional question about whether or not Congress has the right to do that. So it's one of those ideas that makes total common sense to everybody, but it really has a lot more aspects to it than you initially think. Second is that there has been this feeling, and this may be changing, that we kind of like a system that lets some unknown person emerge out of nowhere and catch the imagination and go on to win the nomination and potentially the presidency. That too may be changing as we consider the impact of a president that we currently have who doesn't have much experience, and it kind of shows in the chaotic way that his presidency has unfolded.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about America's presidential nomination system with Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution. Back to your calls. Dennis is with us in Milwaukee. Dennis, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dennis?
Well, my question on all the nomination business and voting and all of that, et cetera, I just keep wondering why we still have the Electoral College.
Oh, very good question, Dennis.
A later stage in the process, but sure.
We still have the Electoral College because it is in the Constitution of the United States, and you would have to have a constitutional amendment and a constitutional convention in order to get rid of it. So, and that's a very, very big deal, and nobody's been interested in going there for quite some time. Now, there are some options out there which are kind of interesting. Even though the Electoral College is the way we eventually pick a president, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that the Electoral College has to be winner-take-all by state, which is what it is in all but two states, Maine and Nebraska. So there's an idea going around called the Electoral Compact, where states would sign up, and if they got to 270, which is the number of electoral votes needed to win, they they would cast their electors or cast their electoral votes according to the nationwide winner, not the statewide winner. And that idea has gotten some traction, and it has some appeal because it doesn't involve opening up the Constitution and amending the Constitution. But basically, it's the Constitution, the explicitness of the Electoral College in the Constitution, which makes it so hard to change.
Time. Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Kurt is with us in Elkhorn. Kurt, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having the show. Yeah. You know, I've got something that is so less complicated than everything that's been suggested. I mean, if we want to get primaries up and voting up, let's just do like they do across the pond. Either make the voting day a national holiday, or hey, let's put it on a Saturday. You know, sometime when, you know, all the people out there that really want to vote would have the time to get transportation and there would be a lot more things available. I mean, this is just too simple, and I understand why they don't want to do it. But
thanks a lot for the call. Just a couple minutes left. Elaine, here in Wisconsin, and I think in most states, it's a Tuesday primary, just like it's Tuesday elections.
Yeah. Kurt's absolutely right. The main reason why in other countries they vote more than we do is that they either have it on a weekend or they have it on a holiday. I totally agree with him. It's something that we should do, and nobody has done it yet, but we can still hope.
Thanks a lot for that. You know, what would be interesting, Elaine, you mentioned that people like to see that Cinderella story. Somebody comes out of nowhere and makes a name in the primary process. Something that used to happen that was more dramatic was the contested primary, where the party would have to vote 83 times to get James Garfield on the ballot or whatever the case. I made up that number,
right.
Something like that. Are we ever going to go back to the days of the contested convention?
Oh, we very well could. I mean, we haven't had it because momentum seems to carry somebody to an eventual win by the time the primaries are over. But any time that the primaries are inconclusive, in other words, if you have, let's say you have three candidates and they're all going into a convention with hundreds of delegates to their names, you're going to have a contested convention. Just because it tends not to happen lately doesn't mean that it's impossible. And it certainly could happen. And at that point, we would see something that we really haven't seen since the 1950s. We would see an old-fashioned convention where the delegates themselves would be bargaining with each other and talking with each other and trying to come to a conclusion. And that would be pretty interesting.
Elaine, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, author of the book Primary Politics. She joined us to talk about why presidential nominations are so different from state to state and how it impacts who gets nominated. A division of the Public Service Commission known as the Wisconsin Broadband Office plans to have internet access to all state residents by 2025. According to Broadband Now, a website that measures the availability of high-speed internet, Wisconsin is the 36th most connected state with 87% coverage. Republican State Senator Patrick Teston told WPR's regional show The West Side that getting to 100% in less than 6 years will be tough.
It's a lofty goal, and one, if we can hit it, that would be fantastic. I think it sends a strong message that, you know, this is an issue that has bipartisan support that we can all get on board with and ensure that we can connect every corner of the state.
That's mostly a rural story, and it's mostly about access. But our next guest says the biggest hurdle to getting everyone online isn't so much a lack of access, but convincing those who are offline to join the digital age, and that it's mainly an urban problem. Larry Downs is a project director at the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy and the co-author of the new book, Pivot to the Future, Discovering Value and Creating Growth in a Disrupted World. He co-wrote a piece on the digital divide in the Washington Post. Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, we've talked a lot about rural broadband access here on this show. You're pointing toward an exactly opposite problem when it comes to people being connected to the internet. What's going on out there?
Well, there certainly is a rural access problem. It's gotten much smaller, and it'll continue to get smaller. But I think our concern is that the focus on rural and the focus on access takes away from the issue of urban connectivity, where the problem isn't so much access, it's not even affordability, it's making sure that people understand the relevance of connecting to the internet in the first place.
So in urban areas, do I have this right? People potentially have the access if they want it, probably they can afford it, or there's some support to help them do that, and they don't for whatever reason. Is that right?
That's right. And for whatever reason, which is that they don't think it's relevant or important in their lives. Not surprisingly, the groups that are most likely to not be connected at home, and particularly we're talking about home connection rather than mobile connections, but the people that are least likely to be connected at home are people who are either poor or older or less educated. That's the real digital divide. And for a lot of reasons, those three demographics, which are much more common in urban than rural areas, don't see the relevance of being part of the internet society.
Well, there are probably people out there listening right now who aren't connected and thinking, yeah, that's fine. I'm happy with it that way. Some people are connected, might think that sounds kind of nice. What's the case that that should be made, you think, to people about why it's relevant to be connected?
Well, we think that a lot of the folks who aren't connected, as I said, they're generally older, they're poorer, and they're less educated, that there's actually a lot of value for them in the internet that they don't really appreciate. So, for example, older Americans, increasingly, you know, the idea of aging in place, that is staying in the home, will be a function of technology, of coming technologies in the Internet of Things and others, but also of connectivity to be able to connect to health services, to continuing education and so on. And if older Americans don't really understand that technology is available, well, then they may not appreciate the relevance to their lives of having it.
Talking to Larry Downs from the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy about a digital divide that shows itself mostly in urban areas in the United States where people have access to high-speed internet but choose not to connect to it. Larry, let's talk about some of the specifics that you brought up in your piece. Parents, low-income parents, I think a lot of people see more and more. You want to keep tabs on your kids' homework, talk to your kids' teachers, sign them up for stuff. It almost all happens online these days. Is that one of the areas of concern you have?
Yeah, it sure does. And it is one of the areas of chief concern. Obviously, education, not just for young kids, but also for adults, people looking for jobs. The education opportunities, employment opportunities, increasingly everything is, as you say, online. Kids get that, and of course, they'll all have their cell phones and smartphone connections, but we don't really think that's the best way to do homework for a lot of reasons. We think a home connection is much better, and obviously, if the parents don't appreciate that, they may be, you know, missing out on opportunities for their kids that they probably wouldn't want to if they understood just how valuable it is.
Yeah, I've heard stories in communities where after libraries close, people park in the parking lot to be able to use the internet access so their kids can do the homework.
Yes, there are stories like that. As I say, increasingly, mobile connections that people pay for are there, but sometimes they have, limits on how much data you're allowed to use in a certain month. And they're not as fast, although they're both of those things are improving in a sense that it may be that that wireless opportunities may solve a lot of these remaining problems of access and affordability, but they still don't solve the relevance problem.
And you mentioned that often it's lower income people or seniors. And in your piece, you mentioned these might be people who are dependent maybe on some kind of a government assistance or rely on some kind of government information. How big an obstacle is that if they're not online?
Yeah, it's a huge obstacle. And if you sort of want to be, you know, a selfish taxpayer and you're saying, well, what do I care if some people don't want to be on the internet? Well, the fact of the matter is that, as we say, a lot of the people who aren't online are heavy users of government services. Those services can be delivered much more efficiently, much more effectively online. But if the seniors and the rural folks and the poorer folks and less educated folks aren't connected to the internet, they're going to continue to, you know, stand in line at the DMV or at other government service offices. And that's not good for them. But as taxpayers, it's not really that good for us either.
When we hear about lack of access to broadband in rural areas, people talk about it as an obstacle to things like entrepreneurship, to economic development. Is even though it's not an access problem, is this a thing you're worried about in these urban areas where people aren't online?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the employment potential, obviously these days, almost any job you're going to apply for, even a minimum wage job, it's easier or maybe only possible to apply online, but also getting kind of training, skills development. These are things that are offered by governments and private institutions as well. All that stuff is moving online. If you haven't got access to it, you know, you're hamstrung in many different kinds of employment opportunities.
If I don't have broadband infrastructure in a rural area, that's a logistics and infrastructure problem and solution, I guess. What's the solution? Is it a public relations outreach effort that is needed here?
Well, in the rural areas, as I say, there are indeed still parts of rural America that are not connected, that have no access to high-speed internet. They have no option at all. Of course, there are also parts of America that still don't have indoor plumbing, a problem we've been working on a lot longer. So part of it is definitely some infrastructure investment, and that's, you know, being done by both private and public resources going at it. But yeah, if you have access and you don't make use of it, you may be missing the opportunity to, you know, smart farming for agriculture is a huge and a growing part, again, of the Internet of Things, where we'll start to get much more efficient use of land and resources, and even long-term for sustainability and better environmental uses. We want farmers, we want rural people to be connected, not only for their own good, but for the good of society.
But in the urban area where people have access but aren't online, what's the solution there? How do you get them, how do you invite them in?
Yeah, well, part of it, as you say, is a public relations problem. We need to make clearer to them just what the value is of being online, why it is relevant, what government services in particular are already available or will be soon available that would make their lives much more easy and much more convenient and save them time and save them extra trips to various offices. And I think, again, particularly we want to target the communities that are most at risk here, so seniors. Understanding all the opportunities technology provides for aging in place, for less educated Americans, all the opportunities for improving their skills and for employment. These are the kinds of things that both public and private institutions need to do a much better job of educating on, as well as digital literacy. You know, one of the other main reasons that we saw in the surveys that show why people refuse available internet is that they don't know how to use a computer. They don't even know how to use a tablet. They're certainly, you know, afraid of the sort of, you know, all the equipment that has to go in your house and work to get it going. So digital literacy is another big piece of it, and some of the ISPs that are offering low-cost internet access to lower-income people do include digital literacy, low-cost devices, and so on as part of those programs.
A lot of our politics happens online these days. A lot of our public information access is online. Is there, as part of this digital divide, do you worry about a problem of democracy where people who aren't participating are locked out in some ways?
Yeah, I think that's another important issue. Obviously, you know, full participation in civic life, as we say, is increasingly an online activity, or at least partially an online activity. And the folks who are not online, not connected, are definitely missing out on the conversation. And I think more to the point, we need to hear their voices as well. So, you know, if we don't hear from older people and the less educated and the poor in the conversation, we may not really be getting a full conversation about important public policy issues. So it's in everybody's best interest to get them online.
As we wrap up, Larry, do we have enough information to know what a trend is? Is this a problem that is slowly being solved, or are we stalled on this?
Well, we're making great progress on both the access and the affordability problems. We've seen that in the surveys and in the data over the last 20 years. But in fact, the relevance problem is getting worse. So not surprisingly, as we have fewer and fewer people left who aren't connected, you know, they're pretty dug in. They're pretty determined not to be connected. And so, in fact, the number of people who cite relevance or need as the reason not to be connected is going up. It probably will continue to go up as the number of people itself gets smaller.
Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Larry Downs is a project director at the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy. He's the co-author of the book Pivot to the Future, Discovering Value and Creating Growth in a Disrupted World. He says it's primarily urban households, not rural ones, that are lacking internet service. And it's not because of access, but people choosing to stay offline. Two more people have been arrested in connection to a massive counterfeit vaping cartridge manufacturing operation in southeastern Wisconsin. The mother of two brothers accused of being behind the operation was arrested for allegedly allowing them to use her real estate office to assemble the cartridges. Another woman is being held on possible charges of manufacturing or delivering marijuana. Jacob and Tyler Huffines were arrested back in mid-September. At the time, law enforcement said their cartridge operation could be one of the biggest in the country. Our next guest has been reporting on this story, joins us now to give us an update on what's happening. Raquel Rutledge is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Raquel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Before we get to the new arrests, remind us of the original arrest and the scope of this bootleg cartridge ring.
Yeah, the original arrests happened earlier in September when Kenosha police, working in tandem with the folks from Waukesha, executed a search warrant at a couple of places down in Kenosha, one at a condominium that was rented by Tyler Huffines under a fake name, which was also being managed by his mother, Courtney Huffines. And that operation was police found in that condo, roughly 90,000 cartridges that were empty, 30-some thousand that were filled. Just a massive operation with THC oil, 57 jars of THC oil, and just, like I said, a massive operation underway at that condominium. And also at the home in Paddock Lake where the brothers lived, Tyler Huffines and his brother Jacob Huffines live with their mother and grandfather. They also found cash and weapons and marijuana and other things at their place as well.
So the two brothers had been arrested originally. Talk about the more recent arrests.
Well, just in the last 2 days, we've had Courtney Huffines, as I said, that is the mother. She's 43, and she is a longtime real estate agent in the Union Grove and other areas around. We're seen in Kenosha. And then also a 19-year-old, soon-to-be 20-year-old young woman, Hannah Curdy, was also arrested. She, according to the criminal complaint filed today, she was involved with filling the cartridges at the real estate office in July and August of this year. So a short time for her to be involved, according to the criminal complaint. But that's all. It doesn't have a lot of new information in it from her.
And this is all going on as health officials are trying to track down these mysterious illnesses linked to vaping, to e-cigarettes, and it appears more and more likely linked to these bootleg cartridges coming from somewhere and probably THC. What are you watching for on that end of this whole illegal vaping story?
Yeah, I just hung up with the folks from the CDC and FDA that had a conference call and where they said this is not declining. This outbreak is not declining. They have had an additional 275 cases reported in the last 2 weeks. They consider it a very concerning outbreak. They have now more than 1,080 confirmed or probable confirmed cases. The average age of the illnesses is 23. Vast majority are male. 70% are male. There have been 18 deaths now reported and linked to this. And so what they will say still is they don't have an answer. So it's not what we want to hear at this point, but they have not narrowed it down. So while a lot of the folks have reported using THC with or without nicotine, when you look at the statistics, it's 36% say they were vaping THC oils only, whereas like 17% said nicotine only. So there's a lot of questions out there. Still, it also comes in the wake of a report from Mayo where there's a doctor there that did 17 lung biopsies, and he's finding something a little bit different than what was originally thought, where everyone was kind of looking toward this vitamin E acetate, which was thought to be causing this pneumonia-type lipioid pneumonia. These lung biopsies are now showing like a toxic inhalation injury, which is a little bit different and actually goes back to what I had written about 4 years ago. When I first started writing about vaping, which is there's some chemicals that can cause this major lung injury that basically causes swelling, inflammation, and scarring to build up, and that blocks the airways. So a lot of questions out there still.
And that the last thing you just mentioned, the thing you wrote about 4 years ago, is that something that might also be in legal, not illegal, not just illegal, but legal vaping products?
Absolutely. We did some testing here at the Journal Sentinel and other tests have been done subsequently that have found these two chemicals, diacetyl and 2,3-pentanedione, which are known to cause, in occupational settings, major, major lung damage. They've been responsible for deaths of microwave popcorn workers, as well as injuring coffee workers, which is something we wrote about also. And they are definitely can be found. We found that some of the liquids that claim to not have them in there actually do have them in there because they're just not testing at sensitive enough levels. Whereas when we did sensitive testing, we found it. So, like I said, a lot of questions, and that those chemicals are known to cause lung damage.
Talking to Raquel Rutledge, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, following two threads on vaping stories. One, mysterious vaping linked illnesses around the country, and thread two, arrests of a major bootleg vaping ring with THC cartridges here in Wisconsin. Raquel, I'm guessing those two threads, the dots are not connected between them, right? We're not at a point where anybody's saying the Huffines operation is linked to these incidents of illness. Do I have that right?
We are not there, and I suspect it's going to be difficult to prove. But what I can tell you is that Leslie Basie, the assistant district attorney from Waukesha, who is acting as a special prosecutor in the Kenosha case, she said that they handed over 160 cartridges from the Huffines operation to the FDA for testing, because basically they're testing, you know, at the law enforcement level locally is basically, hey, does this actually contain THC? With the FDA, of course, is looking for what else is in there that could, if anything else, you know, could be potentially leading to these injuries. So that is not known.
So we've got two additional arrests in this Huffines case here in Wisconsin of these, again, bootleg vaping products. Is that expected to be the end of the arrests, or could there be more to come?
According to Leslie Basie, there could be more. It sounds like, well, what we know from Tyler Huffines, from the criminal complaint against him, he told authorities that, you know, he was working with at least 10 people there that were involved. And we know there are a couple of confidential informants that are helping law enforcement with this. So I suspect they've got several more names on their list, would be my guess.
And I imagine this is not the only illegal vaping operation in the country or the state. Law enforcement is law enforcement looking for other operations like these?
Yeah, well, they turn out, I mean, I wrote about one about, I guess, 4 or 5 weeks ago, one that was being run out of an operation at a high-end condo complex right in downtown Milwaukee. And those guys were making $2 million a month selling these cartridges. They found, I think it was, if I was going by memory here, but I think it was, they found maybe close to 20,000 cartridges in their operation there, and they were doing the counterfeiting thing as well. So that was one bust that happened. Like I said, that was in April, I think. And then there have been other smaller ones. You know, every few weeks there are some. So it seems to be an easy startup. You can buy the fake packaging online very cheaply, and you can buy these empty cartridges very cheaply. So to start up this operation is not all that difficult, and there's just so much money to be made that I think law enforcement suspects it's much a wider of a problem than we see right now.
Raquel, can you give us some of the commonly used names that we've seen, at least most recently, as packaging, maybe just as a service for parents, teachers, and others to watch out for?
Yeah, I mean, really, frankly, all of this stuff can be counterfeited. I mean, Juul, everyone's talked about Juul, but, you know, that's just the legal big, you know, nicotine popular brand. That can be there are counterfeit Juuls out there. The Dank Vapes is a company that has gotten a lot of attention because it's not a company, actually. It's just it turns out that is a brand that is on a lot of the cartridges that were found locally, and actually they talked about it nationally as well. It's not even a company. It just turned out to be like that's a brand that a counterfeit package that was made that everyone thinks is a brand, and there's no company behind it. So, as you know, there are all kinds of strains and advertisements for different flavors and strains out there. So right now, CDC and FDA are both saying, you know, this stuff just cannot be trusted, even if it comes from a legitimate dispensary. You know, in states where THC is legal, even those have been attributed to a couple of illnesses on the West Coast. So they're not having a lot of confidence in any of these products, and just really are cautioning folks to stay away from them because you cannot eyeball it. You can't guess. You can't look at it and say, oh, I feel like this one is going to be safe. You just don't know.
Raquel, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this.
Thank you for your interest in this story.
That's Raquel Rutledge, investigative reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joins us today to give us an update on a counterfeit vaping cartridge case in southeastern Wisconsin, along with other recent arrests of similar operations and the ongoing questions about the health hazards of vaping, especially when it comes to bootleg products. Though, as she says, there are questions about all kinds of vaping. Want to hear from you if you've encountered these bootleg vaping cartridge products in your community, your family, your school. Email ideas@wpr.org. Yesterday on the show, I mentioned the White House mouse that fell out of the ceiling and onto reporters earlier this week. And I shared some White House rodent history, including First Lady Caroline Harrison deploying ferrets to hunt for rats and mice in the White House walls. Here's another story shared by WPR's own Brady Carlson. You hear him on our newscasts on the Ideas Network. He's a student of presidential history. Brady's story is about Andrew Johnson. He's known as the president who came to office after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. And when historians rank the worst presidents in American history, Johnson is usually second or third. This story happened during his impeachment, in which the U.S. House voted to impeach. He hung on in the Senate by a one-vote margin. During the impeachment, he spent a lot of time just kind of hiding out in the White House, and he discovered a family of white mice in his bedroom. Instead of calling for the exterminators or the ferrets, he started feeding them grain and flour and putting out bowls of water so he could watch them play while waiting for his impeachment outcome. He apparently referred to them as, quote, the little fellows. But there was a battle, and not just with Congress. Johnson's daughter Martha was acting as the White House hostess and manager as the First Lady was ill. She led an effort to wipe out rats and mice in the White House with traps, poison, and cats. I'm not sure what became of the little fellows. It's possible their descendants are dropping out of the White House ceiling to this very day. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.